we overpay or underpay our teachers? Do you respect the teaching profession as a whole? Or do you think if you can't do, you teach? Do you blame teachers for poor student achievement? Or do you resent that blame as unfair? Do you think teacher unions are necessary or greedy? Where did all this animosity come from anyway, and how do we get past it? Why is the teaching profession so fiercely admired and attacked at the same time? Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 8 minutes past 6 o'clock on this Tuesday, September 2nd. Happy first day back to school. We are going to talk about how we feel about the teaching profession this hour, the origin of the so-called war on teachers, and how we should proceed to improve the education system in the U.S. And we'll welcome your questions and your views at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Let me welcome our guest. Dana Goldstein is a staff writer at the Marshall Project and author of the new book, The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. Good morning.
Good morning, Joy. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, thank you for being with us. Well, you know, we think of Wisconsin's Act 10, the one that took away collective bargaining rights from public employees, including teachers' unions, as something relatively new. It's only a few years old, but the teaching profession has been an embattled profession for a long time, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's right. And one of the things that I write about is almost as soon as collective bargaining came onto the scene for public school teachers in the 1960s and 1970s, it was incredibly controversial, something that we've been fighting about for decades. And the same goes for teacher tenure now. That dates back to 1909. And we've also been fighting about that almost since the very beginning of the policy.
Oh, my goodness. Well, you begin the book in early 2011, right around the time Governor Walker introduced Act 10. Were you surprised by that move, or did it just seem like another in a line of similar political moves across the country?
Yeah, what Governor Walker did was a more aggressive version of what a lot of cities and states had been considering. And even though Governor Walker is a Republican, what we saw starting in the Obama era, starting when President Obama came into office in 2009, is more and more public conversation about the ways in which teachers were failing. As I point out in the book, it's the only profession that was singled out by the president again and again in his State of the Union address for discussion of how it wasn't doing well enough, and we were looking for improvements. So really you see a bipartisan consensus that teachers should be the focus of reform, that teachers need to be held more accountable, and Governor Walker's decision sort of flows out of that.
Yeah, so why has this issue crossed party lines?
Well, I would say that there are two big reasons why teaching is embattled, or what I call in the book the most controversial profession in America. The first one is that it is a unionized profession, and we see that only 7% of private sector workers are unionized, so I think it's only natural that the rest of Americans often ask, why are teachers enjoying so many protections? They have due process, I don't. They have great pension systems that are going to protect them in their retirement. I don't have that. So there's some resentment there. Traditionally, those extra benefits for teachers have been thought of as a way to offset the low pay. The median teacher salary in the United States is about $52,000 per year. So I think, you know, if we're going to talk about teachers' benefits, we do need to always consider also that it is a relatively low-paid profession, considering that it does require a college and often a master's degree. The second reason why teaching is so controversial is because it's become tied up in our whole debate about inequality. And this is something that I find really dates back to the early 19th century. Americans have always had extremely high expectations for teachers. We expect them to close gaps. Back in the 19th century, it was gaps between Catholics and Protestants. At the early 20th century, it was gaps between new immigrants and the American mainstream. Today, we expect them to close racial gaps, to close income gaps. And while we know teachers have a big impact on kids and can help change individual children's life trajectories, on sort of the big macroeconomic level, teachers have less of an impact than socioeconomic status, than parenting, than neighborhoods. So when we're expecting teachers to close these gaps, we often get frustrated. We get frustrated that they can't do more.
Yeah. Well, why did we start expecting teachers to close all these gaps?
Well, dating back to the early 19th century, you see that the United States traditionally has a weaker social safety net than other Western nations. And what we do have is an education system. So we've looked toward teachers and toward that education system to sort of solve a lot of the social problems that really have their origins far outside the schoolroom.
And so when they don't, we also feel that teachers have failed?
Yeah, I mean, I do make the argument in the book that we have sometimes unfairly high expectations on teachers. It's not just that we kind of misunderstand the role schools play in poverty, that they play an important role, but it is a secondary one. But it's also that we haven't provided teachers with the training and the support that we need to provide them to get the most out of their work.
Yeah. And you also point out in the book that there have been all sorts of reforms proposed to fix the teaching profession or fix the educational system, and they really didn't produce much change.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the first really big reform of American education dating back to the 19th century is making it a profession that's dominated by women. A lot of people don't realize that in 1800, 90% of all teachers were male. Today, 76% of all teachers are female. The reason why that happened is because school reformers back then thought women were sort of more naturally disposed to be good teachers. They almost biologically had this skill of being tender and caring with children. And, of course, the other benefit of women workers is that they were cheaper. You could get away with paying them about half as much as men. Mm-hmm. So that was the first big reform push in American education. Coming into the early 20th century, you start to see a reform movement that looks a lot like the reform movement we have today. It's focused on testing for students, on making teachers more efficient at their work, sort of a top-down reform movement. And this motivates the founding of the teachers' unions, which I'm sure we can talk about later in the discussion.
Yeah.
So a lot of what we're trying today has been attempted in the past.
Well, we'll talk about the origins of the teacher wars and what can be done to improve the education system in the United States as we talk with Dana Goldstein, who is the author of The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. We'll welcome your questions and your input, maybe your experiences as a teacher. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. On this first day of public school in Wisconsin, we are discussing what our guest calls America's most controversial profession, teachers. And we're talking about the teacher wars and welcoming your questions, your responses, your views on this, whether you're a teacher or a parent or anyone else for that matter, in terms of do you think that we give teachers the respect they deserve or not? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Dana Goldstein is a staff writer at the Marshall Project and author of The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. And I wanted to follow up, Dana, with you before we go to the phones on how did the teacher unions begin?
They start in 1897 in Chicago. At the time, 97% of Chicago teachers were women, and reformers believed that that was a problem, that women weren't tough enough to be teachers. There were 60 student classrooms at the time and immigrants flooding into the schools. So what they decide to do is lower female teachers' salaries in order to supposedly attract men to the job and pay men more. And this outrages a lot of female teachers. They come from working class families. Their fathers and brothers belong to working class blue collar labor unions. And the women teachers get the idea that they're going to imitate that. They're going to come together and form a union. And they do so very successfully. And within about 20 years, that union movement for teachers has spread nationwide.
But, as you say, one of the reasons the profession is embattled today is because of resentment over the unions and the protections of unions?
Yes, that's right. I mean, back then, the union movement was growing and gaining strength. Today, it's in retreat. So the idea that teachers have all these protections that other workers don't, I think it discomfits a lot of people. Of course, it's important to remember policemen are also unionized, also paid for with public dollars. So I think the fact that we focus so much on teachers has a lot to do with the task we've given them, which is to close the achievement gap, fight child poverty. The expectations on teachers are so high.
Well, let's take some calls. We have Jan in Baraboo with us. Good morning, Jan.
Good morning. It's Jane, actually. Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
No, it's great. This is my 26th year teaching. I love my job. I can't think of a better profession, to be honest with you.
Wonderful. And my producer tells me that you were the 2014 Wisconsin Teacher of the Year?
That is correct.
Well, congratulations.
And, thank you. It's been a huge honor to represent Wisconsin teachers. But it is. It's a difficult profession right now, I think, And if you look to places like Finland, teachers are revered and their educational system is really highly touted and regarded and it's successful. And I think one thing that they do differently is, first of all, they recruit some of their best students to be teachers and they pay them very well.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the highest paid, people in their country. And so, I think we have to look at how we regard teaching and how we recruit teachers, too, within our state and country.
Yeah. And, well, let's, Dana, what about that?
Yeah, so congratulations, Jane, on Teacher of the Year. That's wonderful. And you're correct. In Finland, the typical teacher is a top 10% graduate. And we know that that's not true in the United States. Our teachers tend to be sort of average in terms of their academic achievement. One thing I always like to mention when we discuss Finland is the scale of our teaching profession is really off the charts compared to a country that is the size of the state of New Jersey. We recruit between 100 and 200,000 new teachers per year in the United States.
Wow.
We actually graduate fewer graduates of selective colleges than teachers we recruit. So that's one thing to keep in mind when we talk about making the profession more elite. And certainly Finland has a very strong social safety net from outside the schools. So they're not expecting teachers to deal with poverty in the same way that we are in the United States. The point about teacher pay is incredibly important, however, especially in the early years of a teacher's career, the first 5, 10, 15 years, we see an extremely flat pay scale. And this is definitely something that dissuades some people either from becoming teachers or from staying in the profession.
Yeah, so
I think people underestimate, too, the hours that teachers spend working just outside of the school day and what they're asked to do. I think there's a real, the perception and the reality are a little bit off as far as just the amount of time. And I couldn't agree with you more, especially for our teachers who are just starting, they really have to take second jobs, sometimes third jobs, to make ends meet.
Yeah, this is absolutely, absolutely true. And nothing frustrates me more as a journalist who has covered teachers for about 8 years now than the idea that they have a short work day. If you know a teacher or you are a teacher, you know that the day is, a lot longer, more challenging and more difficult than those of us who tap away at our laptops all day. So that's absolutely right.
Yeah, and I often hear, too, teachers have the summer off, and sure, the annual salary may not be huge, but you only work 9 months.
Well, I think teachers teachers work such a long day and are so exhausted during the year that I find it difficult to begrudge them the summer off, that even if you look at teacher salary by the week that they work or by the hour, it still looks pretty low compared to other college graduates.
Yeah. So, Jane, what are you looking forward to the most and the least this year as a teacher?
Well, you know, it's always about the kids, and it the fresh start of every new year is always, there's just an anticipation that is palpable. And so, just to see that excitement and to be a part of that energy of the newness that comes from the kids is always remarkable. I work with a great staff in Baraboo. We've got a really great leadership team. So, you know, I'm looking forward to being back. And it's like you have this family that you don't see for a month, and then you come back and reconnect with those relationships. So that's good, too. We're rolling into educator effectiveness, as you were talking about earlier. And it is going to be challenging for all of us, I think, because it's our first time through this new evaluation system. But I also think it has the potential to create a lot of growth for all of us as educators, too. So.
Well, happy first day of school, and thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you very much.
And congratulations again on your Teacher of the Year Award. Let's, Dana, talk a little bit about that. I'm not sure if that's happening in all states, but this new teacher evaluation system?
Yeah, we see about two-thirds of the states in the past 5 years or so have changed their teacher evaluation systems. And one of the reasons why so many states have done this is because there are federal incentives to do so. President Obama's Race to the Top program and also the changes he has made to No Child Left Behind have encouraged states to look at evidence of student performance when they evaluate teachers. And typically this is some mix of student test scores and sort of more rigorous, or what's supposed to be more rigorous, principal observations of teachers' classrooms.
Yeah, so it sounds like teachers are a little apprehensive, but not totally against this idea.
Yeah, I mean, most teachers I talk to say that they welcome accountability. One of the questions they have, which is absolutely fair, and I talk about quite a lot in chapters 9 and 10 of the book, is whether these new systems are going to be effective ones. What does it mean to use a child's test score to evaluate a teacher? How does that change what happens in the classroom when adults are going to be held responsible for raising test scores? Does that mean that test prep becomes the de facto curriculum? In a lot of schools, especially poor children's schools, that can happen. Another question we have is about classroom observations. Are principals really well trained to come into the classroom and take a sophisticated look at what's going on there? This is actually a new responsibility for many principals. The expectation that you would check every single employee's class multiple times per year, it creates a lot of paperwork, it takes a lot of time, and believe it or not, we haven't traditionally thought of principals in the United States as instructional leaders. They tend to be often thought of more as managers. They deal with student discipline. So a lot of teachers are asking, you know, is there expertise, administrative expertise, behind these new evaluation systems?
Let's take another call from Joe in Milwaukee. Hello, Joe.
Hi. My observation is that changes that have taken place over the last, say, 60 years or so in regard to qualifications. At one time, certainly in the what I know of teaching at primary and secondary school, that the emphasis was on the discipline you were teaching. In other words, you had perhaps about 6 hours, if you're going in a college program, 6 hours to qualify to get a certification from, certainly know in the case of Pennsylvania, and I'm sure that was true of other states as well. And then, in other words, if you're going to be teaching history, if you're going to be teaching English, chemistry, whatever the topic area was, that area, that discipline is what was expected in your degree. And education is very secondary as a field or as a subject. Now, certainly in the last 50 years or so, it's totally altered. Your field, whatever you're teaching, it can become secondary. And now it's education. In other words, you have education, even whatever your field happens to be. You may have the teaching of chemistry or the teaching of history, but education has taken over as the topic or the subject. And I think that's very unfortunate because I really question whether, you know, education should have that central as a topic or as a subject or as a major, whereas I think we should be emphasizing more the teacher's abilities in mathematics, in chemistry, in history or in English or whatever the field yeah. is. That should be their major that they have, and then just a minor in education as a subject.
Well, we have just a minute before a news break, Dana. Is Joe's observation correct, and is this a problem?
Well, what the caller is describing as what he'd like to see is what a lot of Asian countries do, and I do think it's a very good idea. Actually, the emphasis on education as opposed to subject expertise has been part of our teacher training in the United States since the 19th century, so there's nothing new about it. It's been a problem for a long time, something reformers debate and discuss and talk about changing in every generation. So it's really a perennial problem.
We are talking with Dana Goldstein. She is the author of The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. We're taking a look at the origins, the history of this controversy with the teaching profession and talking about the path forward. What do we do to improve teaching? What do we do to improve education? We'll talk more after we check the latest news. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. On this first day of public school in Wisconsin, we are talking about what our guest calls America's most controversial profession, teachers. We are talking with the author of The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's coming up on 6:37 on this Tuesday, September 2nd. We welcome your thoughts, your questions, your observations, whether you are a teacher or a parent or someone else. We are talking about whether or not we give teachers enough respect. Do we compensate teachers fairly for the job we expect them to do? Do we expect too much from teachers? Do we blame them exclusively when kids don't perform well? What would you do to improve the system? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Dana Goldstein, staff writer at the Marshall Project and author of The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. And let's just do a quick reset here, Dana. Where does the scrutiny for teachers come from?
I think it comes from the high expectations we place on teachers, that we expect them to fight child poverty and close socioeconomic gaps, even though we know that the family, the neighborhood, and all of those other factors play a larger role than teachers do, although teachers do play some roles. And secondly, that teaching has become unusual in that it is a unionized profession. Only 7% of private sector workers are in unions. So when we look at the protections teachers enjoy, such as strong pension systems and tenure, naturally the question gets asked, is it fair that teachers should have protections that other workers, for the most part, do not?
Yeah. Well, what kind of tenure track should teachers have, and should they be tenured at all?
I'm not sure. Well, here's what I say in the book. Because teachers have so often been attacked politically for factors that have nothing to do with their competence. For example, throughout history, we see teachers punished for opposing certain administrative reforms, such as raising complaints about standardized testing. If you go back further, you see teachers fired because they're pregnant, because they're African-American, because they're Quakers or pacifists or are socialists who oppose certain wars. There's so many reasons why the job can become politicized. So for this reason, I actually think it does make sense for teachers to have an added layer of protection, and that is tenure or due process. In practice, I think it needs to be a more efficient system. It can take years to remove that teacher, it can cost tens or even in some cases hundreds of thousands of dollars for schools to do so. And this creates incentives for principals to sort of look the other way and not to aggressively remove bad teachers. I think that it makes sense to keep tenure if we can streamline it.
Yeah. Should some union protections be curbed after all? And if so, which ones?
Yeah, I mean, there's one particular one called LIFO, or Last In, First Out, that is on the books in many states that I don't think makes a lot of sense. With LIFO, if a school is making cuts to the teaching staff because of a budget crisis, the most senior teachers are protected, and the last in, the youngest, most inexperienced teachers are automatically the ones let go. And I think we're learning more and more, which I write about in the book, about what great effective teaching looks like. And given that we are learning more about what teaching should be, I don't think it makes sense to automatically just get rid of younger teachers without looking closely at performance. So what I say in the book is that the current LIFO system does not make sense. Seniority should be a tiebreaker. It should not be the only factor.
Yeah. So how much should we pay teachers?
I don't know if I have a specific amount in mind, but what I will say is that the median salary, $52,000 per year, is probably way too low. It is true that in a lot of big cities, teachers can get up there toward the six-figure range, but it takes decades and decades for them to do that. So one of the things I read about in the book is that in New York City, which is where I live, where I'm talking to you today, over the first 5 years of a teacher's career, you can only get a $5,000 raise. In North Carolina, it takes 15 years to get a $10,000 raise from $30,000 to $40,000. So what happens to young teachers is that right at the time of their lives where they might be thinking about buying a home or starting a family, they're seeing that their incomes are very flat compared to their college-educated peers. In many professions, you can make big leaps in salary in your 20s and 30s. That's not true in teaching for the most part. So even if we don't allocate a lot more money to teacher pay, we can rejigger it so that teachers enjoy some of those salary bumps earlier in their careers.
Now back to the phones. Jim in Kenosha. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. Your guest just hit the book I was going to talk about a little bit. I'm a teacher and have been for a number of years. And when I got into teaching, the understanding was what I thought about when I made my career decision was, okay, I'm not going to make as much money being a teacher as I would if I did something else, but it's something I want to do. It satisfies me. And so I went ahead with it. But, you know, then my friends who did go into business and industry made more money. I saw, and they got bonuses, they got 401ks, et cetera, and they made more money. They didn't have, but some people actually call it forced unemployment during the summer, which, by the way, when you see the teachers painting houses and doing roofs, they're doing it because they need the money, not for fun. But despite all this, some people seem to want my pension, which, by the way, it used to be that people paid 50% of their pension, and then there was a deal at the state that held down the wages for a period of years, and districts picked up 100% of pensions at that point, so we gave her that. But people want my pension, they want my summer off, but they don't want my job and my salary. Why is that?
Do you have an answer to that, Dana?
Well, you know, teaching is it's a really tough job. And like I said earlier, I think that the resentment toward the summers off is pretty misplaced because it is offset by the lower pay, the challenging hours that teachers work during the school year. And I think the caller is right.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit more, though, about you mentioned that the educational background of teachers, that they're, I don't know, mediocre, academically mediocre, pretty average. What do we need to do to improve that?
Well, it's, as I said, the teaching profession operates at such a large scale in America. It's 100,000 to 200,000 new teachers per year. It's 4% of the civilian workforce. But I have doubts whether it would ever be a profession that, say, only recruits the top 5 or 10% of college graduates. I think one of the big things we can do to help teachers be more prepared when they step into the classroom is make sure that their training actually includes real time in real classrooms where they're watching experienced, veteran, excellent teachers work and getting mentorship. The vast majority of trainee teachers do not get a significant amount of time practice teaching. And sometimes when they do practice teach, it's under conditions that are far from real world conditions. For example, they're tutoring 5 or 7 or 10 kids. They're not working with a class of 20 or 30. So in the book, I talk about some programs that are giving teachers something more like what teachers in other countries experience, which is that you're an apprentice for a full year before you really do the job full time.
Let's go to Keith in Beaver Dam. Hello, Keith.
Hi. Great subject. I was on the school board for 17 years and negotiated contracts with teachers. And, you know, boy, that profession is just so underpaid. And, man, I tell you, at the end of the day, when you're negotiating contracts with teachers, you realize that they're the backbone of the district. And if they're happy and they're successful, everything seems to run pretty smooth. And also at the end of the day, you realize what they're there for, and they're there to take care of, you know, your children. And one thing that always did get me was I looked at the NBA, and some of the top earners in the NBA finished high school, never even went to college, and they're making hundreds of millions of dollars. And our teachers, our society's got to change their priority and put the money where it should be.
Yeah. Do you think that's going to happen, Dana?
I don't think teachers are ever going to make as much as professional athletes, but talking about sports does remind me of one thing, which is that we know American schools spend a whole lot of money on all sorts of priorities that don't funnel into the main purpose, which is kids' education, and sports programs, unfortunately, are one of those things that can be quite expensive for schools and sometimes do detract from teachers' salaries. So it's just something to think about. If you look at other countries, sports and other extracurriculars like that tend to take place outside of school. They're not necessarily part of the school day and part of the school budget like they are in the U.S.
We're talking with Dana Goldstein, author of The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession, talking about the origins of this animosity going on regarding the teacher profession, and wondering where we go from here. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org, or post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. What do you think? Do you think that teachers are compensated fairly or not? How else might you change the teaching profession? And how do you think that could improve our education system? This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with the author of The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. And our next caller is Gary in Lake Mills. Hi, Gary.
Hi, Joy. Thanks for taking my call. Good morning.
Morning.
I was going to say that, you know, Finland came up, and the last caller touched on this also. I think part of the situation with teachers, and I do not believe teachers get the respect and that they deserve from our society, but that's predicated on the issue that our society really doesn't value education the way other societies do. And until that changes, you're still going to have the same problem. You know, our society pays a lot of lip service to education, but in reality, it's not what our society values.
Do you agree with that, Dana?
Yeah, I think Terry's making an incredibly important point. If you look back at the history of American education going back to the 19th century, there's this very strong and pervasive type of anti-intellectualism, which is a thread that sort of runs through In certain eras, we expect teachers to be giving kids a moral, almost a Christian type of education more than an academic one. We see teachers expected to give kids a patriotic education during World War I and World War II. Again, not so much of a focus on the academic curriculum itself. So this comes up again and again, and a lot of people a lot smarter than me have written about anti-intellectualism in American life. This absolutely affects our education system and the respect that we have for teachers or don't have.
Thank you very much, Gary. Next we go to Rich in... Rich, I don't know where you're from. Where are you calling from?
I'm calling from the Kewaunee area.
Kewaunee. Okay.
It's up near Door County.
I know where that is.
Yeah. Well, good morning. And I just want to say real quick that I think a big factor, in my opinion, I was married to a school teacher for 27 years, and I was in a different field, and I actually substitute taught for 5 years, and I have total respect for teachers. But whether it's accurate or inaccurate, what I see in society, it may never change, is the fact that we're working harder than we've ever worked before. We have very little autonomy to our schedule. And the public opinion, whether it's a factory worker or whether it's a high techie that works for Yahoo or whatever, we're putting in 16 to 17-hour days. I know plenty of teachers that do the same thing throughout the summer. But what the public opinion sees is that teachers have time off here, time off there, time off there. And even if they're going in and preparing their classroom work or doing work on a holiday, they don't see it that way. What they do see is that they're working, teachers have time off. It might be inaccurate, and it is probably inaccurate, but ultimately that same factor with my ignorance led to my divorce. That's what I want to say.
Well, I'm sorry about that, Rich. Well, you know, what about that? It breaks during the school year, teacher in service days, days off for teacher conferences and that sort of thing.
Well, I think this is a perceptive point. It's not true necessarily that teachers work less hard. I mean, the best teachers or even the average teacher is putting in an incredibly long day on those days that they do have class. And even when they don't, the preparation that's necessary to teach a lesson is so much deeper than people who have never taught believe it is, and grading papers, and there's just so much to do, parent conferences, phone calls to families, all of this. But Rich's point is well taken, which is that the sort of broader instability of the American labor market, the hours we're all expected to work these days, the issues that so many of us have with work-life balance, the flat pay, the reduction in benefits that so many workers are seeing, people are angry, and I think it's one reason why there's scrutiny on teachers, because they're perceived as being more privileged than the rest of us in some ways.
Now, we've heard about people, teachers retiring after Act 10 in Wisconsin, getting out of the profession. What is the status right now? Are we facing a teacher shortage because of this perceived disrespect?
We don't have a teacher shortage because more young people are actually willing to enter the profession now, in part because of our jobs crisis and high unemployment. Teaching is perceived as more stable. It is something that is hiring every year, even when other businesses aren't. However, we have a lot of teacher turnover. So sociologists who studied the demographics of the teaching profession have noticed that retention is going down. So a lot of people are trying the profession out, but they're not sticking with it over the long term. And one of the things I write about in the book is this reform movement, the pressure around standardized testing, some of the perceived lack of prestige, the problems with low pay. This all goes to the fact of why some people are not willing to do the job over the long haul.
Yeah, and what effect might that have on education?
Well, we actually have really good research on that. There was a study done in New York City a few years ago. It looked at 850,000 students, and it looked at whether they were affected if they attended schools where there was high teacher turnover, so where a lot of teachers quit at the end of every school year. And controlling for other factors like socioeconomics, they found that teacher turnover does negatively impact student achievement, that even if your own teacher is not new, if your school has a lot of adult turnover and churn and burn, your achievement is going to go down. And the reason why is because the environment becomes very unstable. There's a lot of focus on recruiting people into the jobs, not so much focus on improving the instructional practice and making teachers better, but principals just have a huge responsibility to constantly be filling these jobs, and it's very stressful, and it leads to lower achievement for kids.
Sally in Lake Tomahawk is with us now. Hi, Sally.
Hi. I think we need to have teachers teaching teachers how to teach. Just because a person happens to know a particular subject through their college years and does well in it, the ability to teach that, to convey that to other people, is a real art.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely true. And toward the end of my book, I look at something called a teacher residency, which is a program in which a prospective teacher spends a full year as an apprentice inside the classroom of a master teacher. And this is very powerful, sort of observing and getting to watch how a great teacher teaches. We know it's one of the best ways to teach someone how to teach.
And next we go to Cynthia in Menominee. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi. I've spent 35 years in the university system, and I don't think people understand what it takes to qualify, get your teacher certification. Earlier the comment was made that they don't spend time in the classroom. Well, the UW system and the state requires that they spend what comes to a cumulative year observing teachers and student teaching. Somebody just said they don't learn under a master teacher. Teachers in Wisconsin are required to have a mentor, and they have to recertify every 5 years by taking new courses added on top of their workload. There's a lot of misconception. You had to be at the top of the class to get into the UW-Eau Claire School of Education. Those are the top teachers.
Yeah. Well, Dana, are you talking about something above and beyond what it sounds like the University of Wisconsin is doing?
Well, that sounds like a model program, absolutely. In my book, I'm giving the national picture, and it is the case that only about half of prospective teachers nationally spend significant amount of time student teaching.
Yeah. And let's go to Owen in De Pere. Hi, Owen.
Well, good morning. My thought is that we're looking at a lot of activities, but the real measure should be results and results worldwide. We should have a world-class education system, which by all measures, doesn't even seem to be close. And if we did, the respect and all these other things would follow. And until that happens, I think things are going to continue as they are or degrade.
All right. So teachers will get respect when they, I guess, get the results. What do you say to that, Dana?
Well, I think the big question there is always, how do we measure results? And also, are we doing the things that world-class education systems abroad do? And as I write in the book, we really aren't. We aren't providing teachers with the high-quality training and support that other nations do provide teachers to get those world-class results.
Yeah. In less than a minute, I don't know, what do you see an end anytime soon to the teacher wars?
Well, one of the things I write about in the book is sort of attempts at bottom-up as opposed to top-down reforms. So I became really interested in the idea that teachers themselves are often the place to look for new ideas. We see a lot of top-down efforts to reform the profession, so by changing the way teachers are held accountable, holding them accountable for kids' test scores, but we don't often look at what the best teachers are doing at the classroom level and then try to replicate that. So a number of the callers have made the point, and I've made the point, that teachers need to be learning from other teachers.
Sounds good.
So one of the things
I'm sorry, we're going to have to leave it there, Dana. We're out of time. Dana, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Joy.
Dana Goldstein, author of The Teacher Wars. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.